might have tried to sneak past the dogs, or to trick or intimidate them. Daniel did none of these things. Instead, he prayed. He prayed to his mother that the dogs might know how he was feeling. The dogs at once began to weep. They tipped their heads back, and instead of howling, they let big tears roll out of their eyes and into their fur. They wept as they understood that Daniel was afraid that he might be going into the desert to die alone. They wept as they understood that Daniel could not bear the thought that he might not see Bichoraro or his family again. They wept as they understood that he was in love with Marisita Lopez and still, even after all of this, longed for there to be a way to spend his life with her. As the dogs cried and whimpered, Daniel walked past them. He did not try to comfort them, because he knew there was no comfort. He could hear the strange sound of his darkness moving in the shadows on the other side of the house, but he did not flinch. He was the saint of Bichoraro, and he was determined to walk out of Bichoraro without harming his home. Diablo Diablo persisted.
You didn't see where he went after that?
No.
Just now, you were wandering in the desert after him with no idea of where he went.
I had to start somewhere. I can't imagine him out here alone. And his family can't help him. I can do something, and so I will.
How long are you intending to wander?
As long as I need to, Marisita said.
Daniel was overcome then, and allowed one tear to fall. He would spare one drop of his precious water for this feeling to escape him.
As long as you need to? And what if you haven't found him by tomorrow?
I will eat some of the food I packed for him and keep looking.
And the next day?
The same.
And the next? And the next?
I'm going to look for him until I find him, Marisita insisted.
There was a long pause here, and Joaquin seemed to be struggling to find a way to put his next question into words. Finally, he merely asked it as it had first come into his head.
Marisita, are you in love with him?
Yes.
Daniel spared another drop of water. The tear fell to the dust. A pack rat raced out from the brush to grab it, certain it was a jewel because of its shine in the firelight. Daniel's sorrow had made it tangible enough to carry, and so the pack rat bore it back to its nest, only to later find that offspring raised on a bed of sadness failed to thrive. Diablo Diablo said,
Marisita, there is a problem with your quest. We have a source here in the station who is telling me that if you were in love with him, you can't look for him. If you're in love with him, the family darkness will come on you too, if you help him.
Marisita did not immediately answer.
I think you better play another song, she finally said. I need to cry some more.
Diablo Diablo did not immediately answer either. Daniel suspected, correctly, that this was because he was trying to find another thematic song in his pre-recorded session. He put on Paul Anka's It's Time to Cry. When it was through, he said,
Last question, Marisita. The saint's darkness came to him because he helped you and interfered with your miracle. How did Daniel help you?
Daniel curled on his side, the top of his head touching the radio so he could feel the vibration of the speaker against his skin. He closed his eyes, though his blind spider's eyes stayed open to the night as they always did. In a small voice, Marisita said,
I don't want to answer this one. I'm sorry. It just makes me cry too much. I can't tell this story to someone else yet.
That's all right, Diablo Diablo soothed.
After a pause, he added, in a somewhat less Diablo Diablo voice,
Marisita, he'll be okay. He's too good not to fight it. Maybe we can have you on the show again?
Marisita said.
I'd like that.
Daniel opened his eyes. But it was not very much brighter than it had been with them closed. Chapter 14. Being a pilgrim was a hard row to hoe. Nearly every person who came to Bichoraro believed that the first miracle was the end point of their journey. They had only to make it to the point of receiving it, and then their soul would rest easy. Things went pear-shaped for many when they understood it was the first of a two-step process, and as time passed, pilgrims began to fall into two increasingly disparate groups. Those who performed the second miracle almost immediately after their first, and those who, with every unsuccessful day following the first miracle, became increasingly unlikely to ever perform the second miracle. Marisita Lopez was growing ever more frustrated with her status in the second group. Although she was not surprised, she had a very poor opinion of herself. This was because Marisita believed in perfection, and held herself to that standard. If you're a wise person, you understand immediately that this is not a logical goal. The conception of perfection exists only so that we have something to strive toward. Impossibility is built into it, which is why we call it perfect, instead of extremely good. The truth is that only a few things in history have ever been perfect. There was a perfect sunset in Nairobi in 1912. There was a bandoneon constructed in Cordoba that perfectly captured the drama of human existence in just a single note. Lauren Bacall's voice was unmatched perfection. Marisita believed that a few people could reach perfection if only they tried hard enough. And as she had been trying, and had not reached it, she considered herself a failure at all times. No one else counted Marisita as a failure. The number of things Marisita could do extremely well was a large one. She could do everything expected of a woman in the early 1960s. She could clean, and she could cook, and she could sew. But she could also play the foot pedal loom like Paganini played the violin, and it was said that the latter had sold his soul to the devil for his skill. She formed pots out of clay that were so striking that sometimes, when she went to gather clay for a new one, she discovered that the clay had eagerly already begun to shape itself for her. Her voice was so well trained that bulls would lie down when they heard her sing. She was so famed for her studied and just empathy that men and women would come for miles to solicit her as mediator in disputes. She could ride two horses at the same time, one leg on each horse, and still hold down her skirt to maintain her modesty, if she felt like it. Her ceguesa, developed from an ancient recipe, was so excellent that time itself stood still while you were eating it in order to savor the flavor along with you. All of this was to say that Marisita was not perfect, but she came much closer to it than many people. But when you have set your sights on perfection, nothing less will satisfy. The day after her radio interview, Marisita prepared for her next journey in search of Daniel. Although she had been frightened when she learned that her love for him made her vulnerable to his darkness, it hadn't changed her resolve to search for him. After all, it was no more and no less the risk he himself had taken when he'd offered his help to her. However, the interview had given her the moment of introspection necessary to realize that her plan to search for him incessantly, without returning for supplies, was suspiciously close to her previous decision to walk out into the desert to die. When she examined her motive for searching constantly without replenishing her supplies or health, she was dissatisfied with the imperfection she found there. Marisita modified her plan to one that would circumvent any of her previous poisonous motivation. She would search for Daniel daily, but she would also spend enough time in Bichoraro each day to stock up on food and water and to sleep. Before, she had wanted to go out into the desert because of despair. She vowed that now she would go out into the desert only in the name of hope. She at least owed Daniel this new purity of purpose. Now she cooked a new batch of tortillas to take with her that day. Although she was not a perfect cook, she was so much closer to perfection than anyone else had ever seen that she had been asked to be the official cook for the pilgrims. The food she prepared smelled and looked so wonderful that the Sorias were envious, though not envious enough to risk eating Marisita's food. Rosa was the only Soria to cook now, as Antonia was too angry to cook and Judith had moved, and even she cooked listlessly since Rosa herself dined only on gossip. So her near perfection was only for the pilgrims to enjoy. It was a difficult thing to prepare food when the sky was always raining on her, however, and so special accommodations had been prepared for her. She already lived in a somewhat unusual home known as the doctor's cabin. It was the oldest surviving building in Bichoraro, and dated from the decade when the Sorias had arrived. It had never been occupied by a Soria, however. It had been built for and by the first pilgrim to come to them in Colorado, a doctor who'd received the first miracle and then remained with them until his death. He had never confessed to the Sorias why he had come to Bichoraro. His darkness had built up inside him after he'd won a fatal duel with another doctor over 40 years before. In many ways, the doctor's cabin was an appropriate home for Marisita to occupy, because the doctor worked tirelessly on healing others, but never on healing himself. It was old and crude enough that it still had a dirt floor, and after it was obvious that Marisita was not leaving anytime soon, Michael and Luis had dug a small drainage system through the cabin's 3 rooms in order to funnel water away from her bed and the kitchen. This prevented the cabin from filling with water and drowning her while she slept, and also kept the kitchen counters drained while she was preparing food. A previous pilgrim, now moved on, had used clear plastic and coat hangers to construct her a series of umbrellas in varied sizes. Marisita placed these over the various elements of meals that she was preparing in order to keep everything from becoming waterlogged. It had been difficult at first to see what she was doing through the rain-spattered plastic, but, as in most things, she eventually became extremely good at it.
"How are you today, Mr. Bunch?" Marisita asked.
Theldon Bunch, the pilgrim with moss growing all over his body, had lurched to her doorway as she toasted chiles for a later meal.
"Mmm," Theldon replied.
He had his paperback novel folded inside out and stuffed in his armpit in a way that Marisita found painful to look at.
"Is breakfast done?"
"Breakfast was hours ago," Marisita said. "You missed it. Sleep in?"
"Time got away from me," Theldon replied.
Time was always getting away from him.
"Is there any left, hon?"
"I can make you a plate."
There were always beans simmering, and tomatoes didn't take long to heat, and a few eggs made the plate look full. Theldon slouched and read his book while he waited, scratching absently at the moss growing on his cheek as he did. While Marisita cooked for him, she thought about the radio show and what she would say about her past if she did agree to be on the show again. She wondered if Daniel could hear her, and if so, how he would feel about her telling the story of him helping her. It was a very strange development to be able to speak to the Sorias in any way, and she could not quite get over the shock of having a conversation with them yesterday after weeks and weeks of being told to not so much as whisper to any of them, after a day where she had seen Daniel Soria destroyed for that very thing.
"You're a treasure,"
Theldon said as she handed the plate to him.
"If there's anything I can do..."
He said this every time she handed a plate to him.
If you ever wanted to grind the corn for me, it's hard for me to do it without getting it wet, she told him.
She told him this every time she handed a plate to him.
Okay, that sounds good,
he replied, and left with his plate.
The exchange always ended the same way. Marisita always ground the corn herself. Time kept getting away from Theldon. Rain fell on Marisita. Moss grew on Theldon. A knock on the open door preceded the appearance of a solid-looking young man with considerable dust on his boots and white T-shirt. This was Pete, who had already been working that morning.
"Good morning," he said. "Am I in the right place?"
"That depends on what place you are looking for," Marisita replied.
"Antonia said that if I asked you, you might have something I could take with me to eat while I work."
Marisita disliked the delay, but liked his gentle expression.
"Then you are in the right place. Take a seat."
"Thank you, ma'am, but I'll stand. I don't want to get your furniture dirty. I'm a mess."
This gesture was difficult for Marisita. She appreciated that he did not want to get her stool dusty, but seeing him standing rather than sitting made her feel that she needed to hurry as she cooked, even if he didn't mean it that way at all. She could have asked him again to sit, and could have explained that she did not mind the dust, but that seemed like it might make him feel bad about his decision to stand. So instead, she just asked him in her head and said nothing out loud. He kept standing there, making her feel urgent. She hurried. Pete asked,
"Can I do anything to help?"
"I'm going as fast as I can," she replied.
"Oh, I didn't mean that. I just feel strange watching you do all the work is all."
Marisita was surprised by how he just said this out loud, freely, and also by how it made her feel better about his question. She wasn't sure which part startled her more, that he expressed his discomfort so easily, or that she was put at ease by the explanation. Of course, if she thought about it, she knew this was the way to do it. If a pair had come to her for advice back in Texas, she would have advised them to be free with each other, no matter how foolish it seemed. She did not know why she found it difficult to take her own advice. Now, hesitantly, she tried it for herself.
"I don't mind, but I feel the same way about you standing. It makes me feel strange that you are standing instead of sitting, like I should hurry."
It did not feel comfortable to say it out loud instead of in her head, but Pete let out a surprised laugh that was not at all put out. He clapped his hands against his dirty pants for a moment, and then sat on the stool. She gave him a bowl of cherry tomatoes to eat and occupy his hands while she worked. In this way, they spent a few minutes in easier quiet while Marisita finished the empanadas for Pete.
"I hope it's not rude to ask," Pete broke in, "but why don't they fly away?"
The butterflies on Marisita's dress opened and closed their wings, over and over, as water dripped over them.
"They are too wet," Marisita explained.
"One day the rain will stop, though?"
"Perhaps."
"Will you miss them?"
No one had asked Marisita this before, and she had to take a moment to consider the answer. It was difficult to imagine life without them. The butterflies were beautiful. But it was more that she had now been with them for so long that she could not picture what she would look like without them.
"I think I'd rather they flew away," Marisita said.
Pete was satisfied by this answer.
"Good.
Have you already performed the second miracle?"
Marisita was surprised at herself for saying this out loud instead of simply in her head, but since she had already been forward once with Pete, it was easier the second time.
"Oh, I'm not here about a miracle," Pete said. "I'm just here about a truck. Oh, hey, that reminds me. I feel like a total heel for asking you to do more work, But I better ask, 'cause I bet he hasn't been able to, and even though we're not buddies, I'll feel bad if he starves. Do you know if Tony has gotten anything to eat?
The giant?
That's the one.
She was certain he had not eaten yesterday. In her distress, she had not cooked for anyone since Daniel's vanishing. The other pilgrims had fended for themselves. They had a kitchen of their own, after all, and leftovers. But Tony had not been given food, and could not have fit into her kitchen to cook for himself.
"I'll make sure he gets something," Marisita said, feeling more impatient than she sounded.
Time pressed heavily on her, and her mouth felt dry when she imagined Daniel possibly without water. But when she remembered that Tony probably had not eaten since the day before, guilt won out over her impatience. She could be quick.
"Here's your empanada."
"Empanada," Pete repeated. "Gosh, thanks. It looks great. See you later. Sorry about the dirt on the chair."
After he had gone, Marisita hastily prepared Tony some food. She assembled a pile of crusty bolillos, a cantaloupe cut into a bright orange moon, a covered bowl of fried red beans, a thermos of creamy minguiche, two empanadas, three dark red tomatoes from Nana's garden, and a fried bit of beef that had looked a little friendlier the night before. Although it would have been a tremendous amount of food for an ordinary man to eat, Marisita thought it nonetheless seemed insufficient to feed a giant. It was better than eating only memories, though. Halfway through this process, she had a third visitor, although this one took her longer to spot. It was Jenny, the schoolteacher pilgrim who could only repeat what others said to her. She had been standing in the doorway for quite some time, trying to decide how long it would take Marisita to notice her, as of course she could not say anything original to get her attention.
"Oh, Jenny, I didn't notice you," Marisita said.
"Oh, Jenny," Jenny replied, "I didn't notice you."
Marisita wanted to ask how long she had been there, but she knew from experience that it was pointless. She was sure Jenny wanted food, another delay that made Marisita want to snap, but she knew that she would only hear her ugly short words echoed back at her in Jenny's voice. So, Marisita just made her another empanada with the scraps of what she'd made Pete, and then she indicated the food she had just made for Tony.
"Could you bring this tray to the giant? I need to go out." "Could you bring this tray to the giant? I need to go out,"
Jenny echoed, but she held out her hands for the tray. She seemed to be trying to say something else to Marisita, but nothing else escaped her lips. Marisita was quite suddenly overcome with frustration with all of them. Daniel's sacrifice hadn't healed her, because she was too tormented by her terrible past, and Jenny couldn't find an original word no matter how hard she tried, and Theldon kept growing moss, and they all seemed beyond hope. She missed Daniel, though she felt she had no right to. He had never been hers to miss, because she was a pilgrim, and he was a saint, and more importantly, because she would never stop being a pilgrim. She would always be Marisita and her butterflies. Tears were prickling in her eyes again. But no one would even know if she began crying once more, because this rain would never stop.
"We're a mess," she said.
"We're a mess," Jenny replied.
Marisita turned away, covering her face, and by the time she turned back around, Jenny had taken the tray of food away. She collected her thoughts, and she collected her supplies, and she went out to search for Daniel. Tony had also been having a bad time as a pilgrim, although he'd had to endure it far fewer days than Marisita had. All he had wanted when he arrived at Bicho Raro was to find a solution to his hatred of feeling constantly watched. All he had gotten was a body that ensured that he would be constantly watched. His second morning as a giant, he had decided the best course of action was to leave.
"Hang it," he had said to no one.
I'm blowing this popsicle stand.
He currently stood an impressive 20 feet tall. Not tall as far as buildings went, but very tall as far as men went, and too tall to fit into the Mercury. He tried. He would come back for the car, he decided, once he could fit into it again. He put his luggage in his pocket and looked around Bichoraro to see if there was anyone watching him go. There was just that still, owl-eyed girl he had seen the first night. This was Beatrice. He saluted her. She waved. It was a small wave that seemed to say, "Do what you want." So, he left. He limped off into the high desert on his one bare foot and one shod foot. The always-present sun painted sweat on his forehead. Dust billowed up with each step he took. But he was too tall for it to reach his face. Instead, it formed a whirling trail behind him, occasionally tossing up fitful dirt devils before lying back obediently among the scrub. He did not look back. He only walked. Tony was not the first pilgrim to have done this, to have walked out without much of a plan other than to leave. There is something about the expanse around Bichoraro that encourages this ill-advised wandering. Although the desert is not comforting, and there are no landmarks within easy reach, something about the impossibility of it acts as a vacuum to those who don't know their way.
"Crazy fools," Tony muttered as he went.
He walked for the better part of the morning. For most people, this wouldn't have gotten them very far. But Tony's giant footsteps took him all the way to the great sand dunes near Mosca, 40 or 50 miles away. The smoothly scalloped dunes were such an unexpected sight that he stopped short to evaluate them. They were a natural wonder scaled to his current size. The dunes cover more than 100,000 acres, the awesome offspring of an ancient extinct lake bed and fortuitous winds, and are known to produce a peculiar moaning sound under the correct circumstances. 20 years before Tony stepped foot on the dunes, Bing Crosby with Dick McIntyre and his Harmony Hawaiians had recorded a song about them called "The Singing Sands of Alamosa." And now, Tony remembered with peculiar acuity, the single time that he had spun that dulcet track on his show. As he recalled its not particularly remarkable melody, the oversized bare toes of his left foot wiggled and provoked a slow avalanche of sand. As the grains of sand slid over one another, they sang the dunes' legendary song. It was a mournful, eerie wail, and the strangeness of it reminded Tony all at once that he had taken the craziest part of Bichoraro, himself, with him on this walk. He stood there and cursed the unnamed woman who had approached him back in Juniata, and all of her family, and also his enormous Mercury, for taking him there in the first place. The sun gleamed down upon him. He did not shrink. His stomach growled, frightening some cranes nearby. He hadn't eaten since before the miracle, and was hungry enough to be twins. He felt the crawling sensation of being watched. Sure enough, there were two tourists at the dunes that day, a man and a woman who were married, but not to each other. They were staring up at him. As they reached slowly for their cameras, it truly sank in that this walk had been a fool's errand. Until he found a way back to his ordinary size, there was only one option for him. The sands slowly stopped singing. Tony trudged back to Bichoraro. The timing of his return was both fortunate and unfortunate, because just 3 moments before, Marisita had prepared food for him, and 2 moments before, Jenny had carried that tray of food out to where Tony had been spending his days, and just 1 moment before, Antonia's dogs knocked Jenny to the ground and ate all of the food, and also the tray, and also the blank journal that she had been trying to write in since her miracle. And so the moment Tony arrived back in Bichoraro was also the moment when he noticed Jenny, who had remained wordless throughout this experience since the dogs had not spoken out loud while they took her things. Jenny could not explain to Tony why she was empty-handed. She could only stand surrounded by torn notebook pages and clumps of dog hair. Tony's soul was feeling bruised by the knowledge that there was no easy escape for him. So he sounded less humorous and more brusque than he ordinarily might have.
"What do you want?" he asked.
"What do you want?"
Jenny demanded. Tony was somewhat taken aback by the abusive tone in the young woman's voice. He did not yet realize that it was a reflection of his own.
"Nothing,"
Jenny said with the precise same tone.
"Nothing?"
Tony took this as disbelief. He stared her down for a moment, and when this failed to move her, he said,
"You know what? Who came over here?"
Helplessly, Jenny replied,
"You know what? Who came over here?"
Poor Jenny would have loved to explain herself, but of course she couldn't. Moreover, the more distressed she became, the more precisely she mimicked the tone of the original statement. So as Tony grew increasingly exasperated, so did she, which meant the conversation may have grown more fraught if Padre Jimenez had not been making his loping way from the house to Marisita's kitchen to steal a bite to eat and a glance of her ankles. He saw what was happening with Jenny and swung to the rescue.
"Oh, hello, hello, hello," Padre Jimenez said. "I've been looking for an excuse to introduce myself before now."
Tony peered down at this newcomer to the conversation, saw that it was a man with a coyote's head, and said,
"Oh, Jesus Christ, it never ends."
Padre Jimenez laughed in his high, yipping way, and then said,
I understand, but I'd thank you to not take the Lord's name in vain, as I am a priest."
"You're lassie," Tony said.
This was an insult that had force in 1962, as the television show Lassie, starring a winning collie dog and the boy who loved her, had been running for 8 years and was well known. Padre Jimenez's coyote head did not bear much resemblance to a rough collie, according to the American Kennel Club rough collie breed standard at the time. The head should be long, fairly narrow, and flat, ears small, set well back on the head and carried semi-erect but not pricked. But the meaning was still clear.
"We don't judge here," Padre Jimenez intoned, which wasn't particularly true, but in an ideal world would have been. "Everyone's darkness manifests differently. Jenny here, for instance. I was about to tell you that she can only repeat what someone else has said to her in a conversation."
"Is that true?" Tony asked.
"Is that true?"
Jenny echoed.
"Well, Mary's nipples. How would I be able to tell if you were having me on?"
Jenny cast an apologetic glance at Padre Jimenez.
"Well, Mary's nipples. How would I be able to tell if you were having me on?"
"So you see," Padre Jimenez demurred.
Tony rudely whistled the theme song from Lassie. This might have troubled another man, but Padre Jimenez had been here long enough to see that all kinds of people had all kinds of coping mechanisms. And what was happening now was that despite being made into a giant, it had not properly struck Tony before how miraculous the Sorias and Bichoraro really were. He had performed the common mistake that many do when confronted with the idea of the miraculous. He had assumed it meant magical. Miracles often look like magic, but a proper miracle is also awesome, sometimes fearful, and always vaguely difficult to truly wrap your mortal head around. Slowly, it was dawning upon Tony that he had not contemplated the full scope of the place, that he was but one of many recipients of peculiar miracles. Padre was patient enough to wait for him on the other side of this dawning. Tony said,
This is a madhouse.
The world's a madhouse, Padre Jimenez corrected. This is a place to heal it. What's your name, traveler?
Tony.
Tony, I Jenny.
What? She's not going to say that too?
You were talking to me, not her. And the poor dear only has to repeat what's said to her, fortunately for her, said Padre Jimenez. No last name to go with that Tony?
Nope, just Tony.
Well, all right. I'm Padre Alejandro Marin Jimenez, but you may call me whatever makes you comfortable. I'm here for your spiritual enrichment.
From your head, it looks like you're supposed to be here for your own spiritual enrichment, Tony said. I'll handle myself, thanks.
Suit yourself, Padre Jimenez said. But it can be lonesome to be out here and not talking to anybody. Jenny, what is all of this scattered on the ground here? Is this your notebook? Is that an edge of Marisita's flower tray? Were you bringing Tony food?
Jenny repeated all of this back to him, but because she trusted Padre Jimenez and was a little calmer than before, she managed to make the final question mark sound like a period.
Those dogs, Padre Jimenez said.
Those dogs, echoed Jenny.
We'll get you some food, Tony.
Tony was hungry, but he was also thinking about the thing he feared more than anything, being watched while he ate. He vowed to find a private location to feed himself when food did eventually show up. As he was quickly scouting for places that would make good view blocks, he spotted Joaquin Soria peering at him around the corner of a house. When he caught Tony looking, he vanished quickly. Tony narrowed his eyes.
Who's that poking around?
Padre Jimenez didn't turn his head. He just sniffed with his coyote nose. Joaquin Soria, one of the younger boys. Tony narrowed his eyes.
Why is he spying around?
Boys will be boys, Padre Jimenez said carelessly. Might as well get used to the Sorias, Tony. They live here too.
Oh, hold it right there, Padre, Tony said. I'm not intending on living here. I didn't drive all the way here to get a miracle just for the miracle to be that I'm living in someone's backyard. This desert's giving me a nosebleed and this sun's giving me a headache. I'm figuring out what the hell I have to do to get myself right and get myself out of here. Right, Jenny?
Right, Jenny?
Jenny echoed, startled. But after a pause, she nodded too. Because other people's words had been the problem for so long, it had not occurred to her before that minute that sometimes someone else's words might be exactly what she needed to say how she felt. Later, this new knowledge would come in handy, but for right now she felt only a hint of the value it would have for her. Padre Jimenez noted the complexity of this exchange.
Priests are a bit like owls in that some of them also have a sense for when miracles are afoot, and he was having that suspicion now. Some priests fly like owls too, like Padres Quintero, Lopez, and Gonzalez, who all received the gift of slow-motion flight as a result of the first miracle when they arrived to Bicho Raro together in 1912. But Padre Jimenez was not one of them. He said,
"Sometimes it is good to be hungry."
Chapter 15. Night fell, and the stars sauntered out. Night fell, and the owls opened their eyes. Night fell, and Beatrice had not yet cornered Pete. This came as a shock to Beatrice, who had promised Joaquin that she would talk to him about the truck's fate. She kept glimpsing Pete and then losing him, which was not an easy thing to do in Bicho Raro. It seemed particularly impossible since Judith had assigned Pete to a single specific task in a single unmoving location, building a low wooden dance stage, ideal for staging a romantic birthday celebration, ideal for reminding Francisco and Antonia of the circumstances of their first fortuitous meeting.
He worked diligently on that all day, setting legs into the ground and building a framework to rest upon the legs, and scavenging boards from the side of a collapsed barn to be the stage itself. Even though he did not seem to ever take a break from this task, every time Beatrice tried to catch him at it, he vanished. She searched for him near the barn he'd picked over, and she searched for him near the skeletal stage, and she searched for him at all the places in between, and was bemused to find him in none of these places. Then, she would turn and find him back in the place she had just been. She could not understand it. Beatrice could not know that this was because of Pete's decision to avoid her at all costs. He was so eager to keep from experiencing the jolt to his heart at the sight of her, that every time he saw her heading across Bichoraro, he did a quick about-face on his own journey. The closest brush yet came as night moved in. This was after stars had replaced the sun and the sunset was only three colors laid thin on top of each other at the horizon. He was headed back to his room when he saw Beatrice across the open space between the main buildings. First, her shadow, cast long and dangerous by the porch light behind her, and then the rest of her. Pete did a quick turn and marched back the way he had come, glancing quickly behind himself all the while. Beatrice was wearing a flowered dress that was made short by the way she was using it. She had gathered it up into a makeshift basket in front of her and filled it with a strange nest of wires and metal rods and limber twigs. She was not looking at him, but nonetheless she was cleaving to his path so unerringly that he felt as if she was following him. He scuttled into the darkness between two cabins, tripping over something in the blackness, Antonia's dog bowls, and when he looked back, she had turned that way as well. He ducked around the back of the cabin, but she remained behind him. He hurried down the path past the goat pasture, but when he looked over his shoulder, he saw that he had come no closer to losing her than before. Pete's heart was already thudding dangerously, but suddenly he imagined that she might truly be following him with intention, that she might be trying to speak to him, and the idea of that became voluminous in his mind. His heart lurched again. With a gasp, and pressing his hand against the beleaguered organ in his chest, Pete broke into a run around the side of a barn, darted quickly across the yard on the opposite side before vaulting a low set of scrubs. The night stretched up and covered his eyes, so he misjudged the jump. He crashed directly into something solid, which turned out to be the enormous toe of Tony's shoe.
"Hey, kid," Tony said. "Thanks for sparing me the trouble of kicking you."
Pete gasped.
"Shucks." But couldn't get anything more out, draped as he was across the shoe, holding his chest and waiting for his heart to once more become invisible inside him. "Where's the fire?" Tony asked.
Pete slithered down to sit in the dust. He peered up and up and up at Tony's face, barely visible in the dying light, lit only by the porch lights.
"Fire?" "It's an expression. Kid, you're so straight, you make rulers look bad. I mean, why were you running?"
"I think I almost died."
"Me too," Tony said. "Of boredom."
But the two were not displeased to see each other, for no reason apart from familiarity. Tony sat down, arranging himself cross-legged in a scrubby field that cows and calves had eaten down to bare earth. Slouching, he hooked one elbow on the top of the tractor beside him. The bottom of his shoeless foot was quite filthy from all his walking around on it.
"Gosh."
Pete looked all the way from Tony's dirty foot up to his face.
"You really haven't shrunk at all." "Neither of you," Tony said.
"I guess not. What's it like being
like that?" "I can't smoke," Tony said. "Cigarettes are over before they begin."
Pete did not smoke, but he attempted to look sympathetic.
Well, is there anything I can do for you now?
Yeah, beat it, Tony said.
But it was a habit. Pete's company briefly took his mind off his restlessness. Ordinarily, on nights like this, he would have put on the radio or taken the Mercury out across Shurkill Crawlway after all the traffic was gone. There were no highways here, though, and he was a long way off from fitting in the Mercury.
No, wait, kid. Take my Mercury to the closest town and get me a goddamn radio before I go insane. You've still got the keys, right?
Really?
Did I stutter? Here, take some...
Tony began to swear, long and loud, because when he reached into his pocket to get some cash for Pete, he discovered that his money had become giant size as well. He waved a dollar bill the size of a hand towel at Pete.
Owls lifted off, startled by the movement. Tony railed. Get a miracle, they said. Here's your miracle. This isn't money, it's a magic carpet.
I'll cover it, Pete said hurriedly. Until you get normal again. I've got enough for a radio, I think.
Look under the passenger seat, Tony said tragically. Use that. Only the money. Leave the other stuff there.
Pete's mind filled with possibilities of what might be under the seat that he was not supposed to tamper with. But because he was an innocent sort, he was wrong about nearly all of them.
Any particular kind of radio?
A loud one, Tony said.
I'll ask Antonio if I can take some time off tomorrow, Pete promised.
Where is your car anyway? Oh, yeah, Tony said, and moved slightly to reveal the Mercury behind him, the dry scrub flattened behind it.
Pete found that looking at the vehicle next to Tony produced an unusual vertigo. The Mercury, just a little too large to appear as an ordinary car, and Tony, rather too large to appear as an ordinary man.
How'd it get there?
I dragged it, Tony said.
No way.
Tony gave the vehicle a little shove to demonstrate it. The contents of the interior rattling as he did, the car moving as easily as if three men had been pushing it. It was a magic trick that so delighted Pete that he covered a hand with his mouth and backed up several steps, kicking the ground to release some of his thrill.
Gosh, he said.
Gosh, mimicked Tony primly,
but without malice. He was a performer, after all, and this small performance made him happy. He pushed the Mercury in a slow circle so that it came to rest in front of Pete. Dust swirled around the vehicle and the boy.
Some advantage to size. Hey, how's your work? Breaking your back yet?
It's good, Pete said. Real good.
Tony waited, leaving a silence, as if testing the words for veracity, waiting for Pete to renege. But of course Pete had meant it. He had found the stage building intensely satisfying, and he liked imagining the future celebrations that might make use of his day's work. Pete patted the Mercury appreciatively, still pleased at its previous journey under Tony's grip.
God, kid, I can't decide if I hate or love what a square you are.
Pete grinned for the first time.
Better love it, because it's not changing, buddy.
This was the moment they became friends. They became even better friends after this, because time improves on these things. But this was the moment it began. Tony sensed it, because he rubbed the back of his neck and said,
Okay, now beat it.
Beat it? Why?
Because I'm starting to think you're all right, and I don't want to give you a chance to say something that'll change my mind back again.
Okay, said Pete.
But he didn't go. Instead, he tapped on one of the Mercury's windows.
I wasn't looking through your stuff or anything, but when I was sleeping back there, I kept hitting my head on that box, so I looked in it to make sure I hadn't heard anything in it. I've never seen that many records in my life.
Tony had forgotten that he had the promotional records in the back of the Mercury, though, and now he felt a little bad about it. Not because he thought the station would miss them, He'd only taken ones that were duplicates or singles his producers would never play, but because it wasn't good for them to be subjected to direct sunlight.
That's because you haven't lived very long. You got a record player?
You saw everything I came here with. How'd you end up with all them anyway?
Pass, Tony said. Hard pass. Not answering.
Pass? Why? Wait, did you kill someone over them?
Tony burst out laughing.
Kid, you really have got more corners than a box full of boxes. I work in radio. Don't tell anyone.
Why not?
Tony was impatient with this question, as he felt it was the kind of question only asked by someone who had never experienced either fame or notoriety.
Because I said so.
Sure, whatever you say. Like a DJ?
Because Pete didn't seem too awed, Tony grudgingly answered,
Yeah.
You'd think a DJ would be the last person to break the radio in their own car.
Yeah, you'd think, wouldn't you? Now seriously, flake off before I regret telling you.
Tony had been watching Pete closely to see if this confession had changed anything. But Pete was less interested in Tony's past career than he was in his own future safety.
I ought to get some sleep anyway. Is the coast clear?
Of what? Those damn dogs?
No. A girl, Pete said.
It had not occurred to Pete that he had actually weaponized Beatrice's appearance by avoiding her the way that he had. If only he had approached her calmly during the day, he would have been fine.
You mean that girl?
Tony asked. Pete turned.
I need to talk to you, Beatrice said.
Chapter 16. Not a lot of people know that there is a Great Salt Lake and accompanying salt plain in Oklahoma. Most folks are only familiar with the famous one in Utah. But the one in Oklahoma is no shoddy thing. Just a spit north of Jed, Oklahoma, the Great Salt Flats start, the enormous and impressive remainder of a massive saline lake. Like the salt flats in Utah, they are white as snow and as flat as a board. But unlike the salt flats in Utah, Oklahoma's salt flats have treasure buried beneath them. Tiny crystals known as hourglass crystal grow here and nowhere else in the world. And if you are the sort to dig for treasure, you can bring your whole family to dig them up. Just make sure you hose your vehicle down afterward, because salt's not good for any set of wheels. Pete's family had gone to dig up these rare selenite crystals one spring not long ago, and Pete remembered the unrelenting sun, the grid of salt and sand caught in his pants legs, the intimate joy of finding a crystal and holding it to the light to see the hourglass of time within it.
Look, I told you, he's waking up, Tony said.
The image of Oklahoma's salt flat slowly became the starry sky over Bicho Raro.
I need you to go,
said a mild female voice. It was Beatrice, though Pete's gaze had not yet focused on her.
It's dangerous for us to speak.
Fine, lady, Tony said. My legs want to get out of here for a while anyway.
The ground rumbled as he stepped over them both and walked into the night. Pete and Beatrice were left alone. Pete went to press his hand to his chest, only to discover that he had already done it, so he pressed a little harder. He was lying on his back in the gritty dirt, and from the vague ache on the back of his head, he guessed, correctly, that he had gotten there in an expedited way. Beatrice was crouched beside him, holding her skirt carefully to keep the wires she had collected inside the makeshift holder. The air smelled like roses for no reason that either of them could tell. This was because Luis had emptied a wheelbarrow of spent blossoms from Francisco's warehouse in this field,
and Pete had made an accidental bed of them.
"You fainted,"
Beatrice told him. He looked at her through slitted eyes, worried about his heart, but it seemed that now that the sight of her had knocked him on his back in the dirt, looking at her more didn't seem to cause any more hurt. You can only get shocked so many times by the same thing, after all. He said, "I've got a hole in my heart."
"Do you fall down a lot?"
"Only when I'm surprised."
"Do a lot of things surprise you?"
"Not really." Because Pete was still dazed from striking his head on the rose petal-strewn ground, he didn't offer his name nor ask hers, and he did not think to begin polite conversation. And because Beatrice was already uncomfortable about the truck, and because she was not as empathetic as someone else might have been in the situation, and because she was trying not to look at his elbows, she did not think to introduce herself or even allow Pete to stand up as she raised the sore subject of the truck's ownership. Instead, she merely explained that she had heard he was working for the truck, but that her mother had not realized when she made the deal that Beatrice had resurrected it and gotten it running again, and was using it for her own purposes. Only at the end of this monologue, when he was still looking at her dazedly, did she realize she had not solicited his thoughts.
"And so I'm open to your thoughts," she finished.
Pete said, "Antonia, your mother, told me it wasn't running." But even as he said it, he knew Beatrice's account was true, as the truck had been parked in multiple places since he'd arrived there, which was why he had not yet been able to examine it. Because he was a kind soul, this immediately triggered a conflict. He desperately wanted the truck, of course, and was unable to imagine what he might do without it. But he also could not imagine simply taking the truck out from underneath Beatrice if she had indeed invested so much work in it. It wasn't fair. And if Pete was anything, he was a fair person. This dissonance distressed him so much that he thought he could feel his very core beginning to tremble. The ground seemed to be whispering softly against his spine with the movement of some deep and unwinnable debate. In reality, this was because Salto, driven to madness by the lack of radio in the stable, had broken through the walls of his stall and had just rioted the previously sleeping cattle gathered near the barn. They now stampeded directly toward Pete and Beatrice, the stallion at their head. He was an enormous horse, nearly 18 hands tall, and as chestnut as a violin. The cows were red as dirt with white faces and had horns for hanging men on. There were many of them. Beatrice did not wait for Pete to move. She simply grabbed his leg and dragged him out of the animal's path just in time. The wire she'd gathered for her antenna scattered across the ground as she fell on her backside. Dust churned over them both, but all of their insides remained where they belonged. Pete sat up just in time to see the cattle slowly wind to a halt as they reached a fence line. Salto, on the other hand, sailed right over it. Beatrice had no feelings for Salto either way, but she knew as well as any other Soria that his rare and pricey seed put food on their table. She pushed up from the ground and ran.
"What are you doing?" Pete shouted.
"Getting that horse back!"
Pete leaped to his feet, stepping hard into his boot to put it back on, as Beatrice had nearly pulled it off in her hurry to drag him free of the stampede's path. Then he, too, broke into a run, only he ran for the mercury. This was the moment their love story began. It may seem like madness for a young woman to chase a runaway horse, as a galloping horse travels at 25 miles an hour and a galloping woman travels at only 15. But runaway horses rarely have a purpose, and young women chasing them often do. When combined with the asset of a young man in a station wagon, the question of catching the horse becomes a matter of when, not if. But when was still a long distance off. The mercury did